I'm going to call this meeting to order. Good morning, everyone. This meeting of the House Sustainable Infrastructure Policy Committee for January 25th, 2023 to order. A quorum is present, so we will get started. First item on our agenda is the approval of the minutes. Representative Kraft, may I have a motion to approve the minutes for January 18th, 2023?
Madam Chair, so moved.
Representative Kraft moves approval of the minutes for January 18th, 2023. Any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, minutes are approved. So first up on our agenda today is House File 413. Representative Stevenson will be hearing two bills today. And so with that, I will move that House File 413 be re-referred to the Commerce, Finance, and Policy Committee. Chair Stevenson, I understand you have an A8 author's amendment to get the bill in the shape that you would like. I will move the A8 amendment. Representative Stevenson, would you like to explain your amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. The A8 amendment is an author's amendment that gets the bill in the shape I'd like the committee to consider it. It updates language in the cost recovery section of the bill that was developed over the course of last session and in conference, and makes a couple other technical changes.
Is there any discussion to the A8 amendment? Seeing none, I renew my motion to adopt the A8. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Stevenson, please go ahead and present your House File 413 as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House File 413 is a bill related to electric vehicles. The electrification of our transportation system is a process that is well underway. It is a revolution that is occurring in the marketplace largely led by consumer demand. What we are seeing are automakers saying that they are going to phase out internal combustion engines and switch to electric vehicles in their entirety. We're seeing massive consumer demand for these vehicles. When Ford announced that they would... Yes, there is massive demand for it, Representative Branson. When Ford rolled out their new pickup truck, they had a wait list that was months and years long. So there are lots of people who want these vehicles. And they want them here in Minnesota, and we want to make sure that they can buy them here in Minnesota. So this bill results from a series of conversations with stakeholders, including the dealers and our electric utilities and many others, to try and see about what we can do to make this transition as smooth and effective as possible. It contains a number of provisions, including provisions reordering the state's vehicle purchase priority list, some training to allow dealers to make sure that their staff are well-equipped to sell these vehicles, to provide consumers with the information that they need to make a decision about what they want and to maintain the vehicles. It also includes provisions, as I mentioned, to allow the utilities to work with consumers to make sure that they have the infrastructure in place to support electric vehicles. It includes a rebate program and also a grant program to dealers to help them get the new equipment that they will need to sell and service electric vehicles. So it is a comprehensive approach to the problem. I know that I'm sure that there's some other amendments that are offered, and I also know there's some testifiers, and happy to follow your lead and what you want to do next.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson. We'll move to testifiers. So first up is Ms. Amber Backus, and I believe you are virtual, so please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I'm sorry I wasn't able to be with you today. I'm actually presenting about our new EV program director position at a conference of my peers in Dallas. But I am Amber Backus, and I'm here on behalf of MADA and its 350 franchise new car dealers, many of whom are family-owned businesses that have been serving their communities for decades. We're grateful to Representative Stevenson for authoring this bill and the House, which has passed some of these provisions the past two biennium. And hopefully the third time will be the charm, and House File 413 will become law this year. Our members are gearing up to sell more electric vehicles and are going to be essential to the transition, as franchise dealers across the country have sold over 99% of the nation's 283 million vehicles on the road today. However, there are barriers to electric vehicle adoption, including the upfront vehicle price and the cost of electric vehicle infrastructure. And this bill seeks to help overcome those by providing consumer rebates and dealership grants. In 2022, electric vehicle sales in Minnesota rose to their highest level yet, 3.8%. But that's only half as many as dealers will be required to have in their inventory when the Clean Cars Minnesota rule takes effect next year. At the same time, through the Inflation Reduction Act, the federal government has limited the number of vehicles that will qualify for the $7,500 federal tax credit by imposing mineral sourcing and assembly requirements. Why does any of this matter? Because numerous studies have shown that the upfront price of a vehicle is the number one factor that influences what a consumer purchases. And due to supply chain disruptions and skyrocketing mineral prices, the gap between the price of electric vehicles and gas-powered vehicles has grown the last few years, with the average price of an electric vehicle $18,000 higher than the average gas-powered vehicle. The $2,500 rebate, or $3,000 for lower-income Minnesotans, contained in Section 6 of this bill, will help overcome the price disparity and should be a boon to EV sales. The experience of other states with robust incentives to reduce the upfront cost of electric vehicles has borne this out. In Georgia, they had a $5,000 electric vehicle tax credit on the books, but when it was repealed in 2015, EV sales dropped 90%. Other states that have instituted similar tax credits or rebates, as proposed in House File 413, have seen sales of electric vehicles double. And this approach is overwhelmingly supported by Minnesotans, over 70% of both Democrats and Republicans, and can help drive demand, bringing more electric vehicle options and leading to lower vehicle costs. EV prices are also higher because not all dealerships are eligible to sell electric vehicles. They must be certified by their manufacturer to do so, and this is becoming an extremely cumbersome and costly process. For the first generation electric vehicles, such as those Chevy Volts, a dealer's cost to become EV certified were around $15,000 to $25,000. With bigger electric vehicles and higher capacity batteries now on the market, that number has increased 20-fold for some makes, with dealers required to make investments of $250,000 to $500,000 to install more expensive level 3 chargers, larger lifts, and hoists. In an industry with historically low profit margins, dealers are only going to make this investment, one, if they have the resources, and two, if they are confident they can get a return on it. This past year, Ford unveiled a new program requiring dealers to invest either $500,000 or $1.2 million if they wanted to continue selling electric vehicles. That steep price tag caused over one-third of Ford dealers nationally to opt out of the EV market, as their pro forma showed they wouldn't recoup the huge investment costs. Section 7 of the bill establishes a program that will allow franchise dealers to apply for grants of up to $40,000 to help them purchase the infrastructure required by their manufacturers to become EV ready. These dollars will make EV certification more accessible to smaller dealers by helping to alleviate some of their financial risks. Additionally, since dealerships are located on high traffic highway corridors in all corners of the state, more EV certified dealers means more access to charging stations by the motoring public as they cross Minnesota. With a $17 billion surplus, this is a great use of one-time dollars to increase consumer choice and access to electric vehicles, bringing lower prices and reduced emissions to Minnesotans. And I'd ask for your support of House File 413. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Backus. Next on the agenda is Ms. Deb Irwin. If you could please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony, I believe virtually as well.
Yes, thank you very much. Good morning. I'm Deb Irwin, Director of Policy and Program Planning for Clean Transportation at Xcel Energy. I wanted to thank Representative Stevenson and the committee for the opportunity to speak today to the need for legislation that will establish a robust foundation for utility support of transportation electrification. Xcel Energy's role in the electric vehicle transition is to be a partner to the private market and to our states, communities, and customers. We know that successfully supporting growth in EVs will require action from many parties, including charging station developers, gas stations, auto dealers, communities, and others. We see a future where the private market and utilities can work together to make the transition happen quickly and responsibly. Foundational legislation that sets forth the goals and requirements for utility transportation electrification plans is a best practice to support strong engagement from utilities, regulators, and all stakeholders through the regulatory process. Transportation electrification can save Minnesotans money and fuel costs while also providing environmental benefits, but there are significant barriers to customers making the transition to EVs. To date, Xcel Energy has received Public Utilities Commission approval of a variety of pilot programs to support our customers' transportation electrification needs, but we need to do more. For example, currently, Minnesota has less than 5% of the high-speed public charging it needs to hit the state's 2030 goal of having 20% of light-duty vehicles be electric. This massive gap needs an all-of-the-above approach, including a strong utility role supporting the expansion of EV charging in the state. We currently have about 24,000 EVs in Xcel Energy service territory, and that number needs to grow to about 274,000 by 2026 and about 794,000 by 2030. That is Xcel Energy service territory only. The whole state needs to go from about 35,000 EVs currently to over 1.2 million by 2030. This is a big task that will take support from all of us. A great example of the holistic approach that this legislation can bring to all Minnesotans is Xcel Energy's work supporting Our Car's multi-dwelling unit initiative to offer its EV car sharing at 25 low and mixed income housing locations in the Minneapolis and St. Paul areas. Each location will include level 2 chargers and electric vehicles available through the EV car sharing program. Xcel Energy will build the infrastructure for this initiative through the support of our multi-dwelling unit infrastructure pilot. As of this month, the effort is live at 2 locations in Minneapolis with 1 level 2 charger and 2 EVs at each location, and we're excited to bring more locations to life later this year. But as you can imagine, this project just starts to scratch the surface of the benefits that utility transportation electrification plans can provide under a robust legislative framework. The need for additional support is significant, and we want to go farther and faster to meet the needs of our customers and communities. House File 413 will require public utilities to file plans and continue to do so at least every 3 years, specify what's expected to be included, and establish how the Commission will address these proposals. We've worked with Representative Stevenson and other legislative leaders on this effort for the past several legislative sessions and are looking forward to seeing it succeed this year. As with other states that have similar legislation, this bill will create a more robust framework for our plans. Xcel Energy has experience with similar legislation in place in both New Mexico and Colorado, and we've found this type of foundational legislation has provided a valuable structure on the objectives for utility programs. We're looking forward to building upon our current educational and advisory services, charging infrastructure pilots, and managed charging pilots to accelerate transportation electrification and make these programs accessible to all customers. Additionally, coordinated planning through this framework will create predictability that can help maximize the benefits of other state and federal programs, delivering more value for Minnesotans by having a clear process for public utility initiatives. Xcel Energy thanks you for your support for a strong utility role in delivering the benefits of transportation electrification to Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. Next on the agenda is Mr. Jeremy Estenson. Welcome to the committee. If you could just state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jeremy Estenson. I work for Taft Advisors and am here on behalf of the Americans for Affordable Clean Energy, or ACE. ACE is a coalition of forward-thinking retailers from Minnesota and across the country who are eager to invest in electric vehicle charging services. I'm here to share certain problematic provisions within House File 413 and urge that further work be done on the bill. Specifically, House File 413 would open the door for public utilities to expand their monopolies into the electric fuel market. Retail fuel stations have a long history of meeting customer refueling needs by allowing consumers to refuel in safe, convenient locations at competitive prices, and ACE's membership is committed to continuing that mission to serve EV drivers. As EVs become more prevalent, Minnesota needs a network of accessible, affordable, and strategically located fast charging stations to meet consumer electric fuel needs and expectations. House File 413 may appear to be in alignment with that goal, but unfortunately there are provisions that give public utilities an overwhelming advantage in the electric fueling market. Specifically, the bill would authorize public utilities to pass the cost of its investments in EV charging stations to all of its ratepayers through regulatory filings. If allowed, this investment would be shielded from the usual market risks associated with typical business operations. Fuel retailers and other private companies simply cannot compete with power companies that do not have to pass EV charging station costs on to EV drivers, as retailers must. Additionally, the bill would narrow the criteria the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission can consider when evaluating public utility EV charging proposals. This would undermine an ongoing MPUC case where a utility has proposed to rate base over 700 EV fast chargers to the tune of almost $200 million. These costs would be borne by captive ratepayers, which are already struggling with rising electric bills and inflation. ACE members operate nearly 400 fuel retail locations across Minnesota, which are conveniently located and offer the amenities that drivers demand. Utilizing these locations for electric refueling will promote charging accessibility and will ultimately drive consumer confidence in electric vehicles. However, House File 413 would make it impossible for fuel retailers to enter the electric fueling market on a level playing field. Fuel retailers have spent decades improving the consumer experience and acquiring the best real estate to serve drivers. The best way to encourage efficient and rapid growth of Minnesota's EV charging market is for all stakeholders to focus on their core competencies. With fuel retailers providing the customer experience that drivers need and electric utilities focusing on generation of power and delivering the power to locations, and making those sites ready for EV charging station installation. Our hope is that Minnesota does not preclude the creation of a competitive marketplace for electric fueling. Fuel retailers are willing to risk their own capital to solve the EV fast charging challenge. We simply need good public policies in place to give statutory certainty and create a competitive level playing field. Thank you for your consideration, and we look forward to continuing to work with Representative Stevenson, members of the committee, and other stakeholders. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Are there any members of the public who would like to testify on the bill as amended before we move on to other amendments submitted to House File 413? All right, moving on. Seeing no additional testifiers, we'll now move on to member amendments. Representative Anderson, would you like to move the A4 and explain it to the committee, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I'd like to move the A4 amendment. And I offer this amendment to kind of express some frustration, and hopefully it would be accepted, but I'm under no illusions. A couple of weeks back, early in the session, we had testimony from the Department of Admin, and I specifically asked them about the state fleet and how many flex fuel vehicles they had. I was told they would get back to me, and they did not. I called them yesterday, or called the Department of Admin, got a recorded message, and then was told that their mailbox was full. So I didn't get any information back from them, but what my amendment does, it's kind of a placeholder for flex fuel vehicles, which provide immediate reductions in the CO2 reductions or gases. And we do have current statute that requires the department and the state, 16C137 requires the admin and other agencies to, among other things, increase their use of renewable transportation fuels, including ethanol, biodiesel, hydrogen from agricultural products. So my amendment would be a placeholder and make sure that even though it's ranked behind electric and hybrid vehicles, there would be a state initiative to keep looking at flex fuel vehicles because they do have a place here in Minnesota, in Ag State, and I would encourage passage of this amendment, Madam Chair.
Representative Stevenson, any comment on the A4?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Anderson. You know, the flex fuel vehicles are included in the preference that is established or modified in this section of the bill. They are ranked ahead of traditional gasoline or diesel vehicles. I imagine that the state would be purchasing them under that criteria. The piece of your amendment that I object to is the quota, the 25%. And, you know, we had a good conversation about this, good but brief, yesterday. And I appreciate you talking about it with me beforehand. So I can't support the amendment because I don't support the quota aspect of it, but I appreciate what you're driving at here.
Any further discussion?
I'd like a roll call.
Representative Franson requests a roll call. Any other discussion to? Oh, would you like go? Please come up to the identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Julie Byrell from the Department of Administration. Apologies that we did not get back to you. We will follow up as soon as possible. The issue we have with this amendment is flex fuel vehicles are not always available. And so if this were to be included, we would need language that said if available.
Representative Stevenson?
Yeah,
Okay. Just saw you look up.
Sorry.
Any other discussion to the amendment? Representative Anderson?
Well, I would offer an oral amendment to add the word if available, if it would make it any more palatable, if the author would accept that amendment, friendly amendment.
I think this has another step, correct?
It has multiple different
steps. Yeah, so how about we continue to work on the language? And then in the next committee, I believe we're going to Commerce, so that is something that we can continue to work on. I'm also on that committee, so we can have a conversation about that. Any other questions or discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Cagle?
No.
Cagle, nay. Vice Chair Curran?
No.
Curran, nay. Representative Franson?
Yes.
Franson, aye. Representative Acomb?
Acomb, no.
Acomb, no. Representative Anderson?
Anderson, aye.
Anderson, aye. Representative Francis Clardy?
Clardy, no.
Clardy, no. Representative Gilman is excused. Representative Hornstein?
No.
Hornstein, no. Representative Igo?
Igo, aye.
Igo, aye. Representative Kraft?
No.
Kraft, no. Representative Ream?
No.
Ream, no. Representative Schultz?
Aye.
Schultz, aye. Representative Smith is excused.
There being 4 ayes and 7 nays, the motion does not prevail and the A4 is not adopted. We have 2 additional amendments submitted. Would the author of the A6 amendment like to move the amendment and explain it to the committee, please?
I would, Madam Chair.
Representative Franson?
This is another friendly amendment. We are to be good stewards of the money that is afforded to us, as well as take a look at our constituents around the state. This bill here takes advantage of the Excel ratepayers, and those Excel ratepayers should not be burdened with helping wealthy Minnesotans purchase electric vehicles. So I am deleting everything in this this $10 million and appropriating it. So inserting $10 million in fiscal year 2024 and appropriating from the general fund. Representative Stevenson, do you think Excel ratepayers should be wealthy? Ratepayers should be getting the EV vehicles while I heard, I think it was somebody from, was it Excel? The quote was something to the effect of those in, I think she said Minneapolis, but the middle class and lower income people could be renting or doing ride sharing EV vehicles. I think I heard that correctly, which to me seems a little inappropriate. So I hope you take this amendment and we can kick it back to the general fund and let the ratepayers have their RDA fund for their needs instead of subsidizing the wealthy around the state.
Representative Stevenson?
Madam Chair, Representative Franson, first, no, I think you did not hear Excel correctly. They were talking about their partnership with the Our Car program, which is a ride sharing or a car sharing service that it's a commercial service that people buy into and use. So I think you misunderstood that particular comment. To the substance of your amendment, I don't agree that it's a friendly amendment. I also totally reject the premise of your argument that this is subsidizing the wealthy. In fact, the whole purpose of this amendment is to make electric vehicles more affordable and more accessible to the majority of the people in Minnesota. And there's a number of provisions in the bill designed to do exactly that, including a cap on the price of the vehicle that's eligible for the rebate. So, you know, if you're a very wealthy person looking to buy one of the very fancy Teslas that cost, you know, six figures or whatever, you will not be able to get a rebate. I recently read that Maserati is moving to an entirely electric market, which is great. None of those cars will be available for this rebate. In addition, the rebate amount increases if you are a low-income person under a provision of the bill. So I don't agree at all with the premise of that. I also think that the renewable development account is a very appropriate tool to finance this, but of course that's a conversation I'm sure we'll also have in the Energy Committee, which has jurisdiction over the RDA.
Representative Franson.
Well, I disagree with the premise that Excel ratepayers should be subsidizing people in my district who do not pay into the RDA, along with others. Yes?
Chair Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative Franson, they won't be. The way that the bill is set up is the RDA is for people who live in the Excel territory, and then that's Section 8A is the RDA, Section 8B has money from the general fund. So this bill has a dual financing mechanism. If you live in the XL territory, we're using RDA money. And you can see that's written into the text of the bill on lines 10.7 through 10.9. Rebates must be awarded under this paragraph only to eligible purchasers located within, and then that's a legal description of XL. The second section, which is paragraph B, has $10 million out of the general fund. And again, lines 10.12 to 10.14 indicate that rebates under this paragraph are for people outside of Excel territory. So Excel ratepayers would not be contributing funds to people who live outside of Excel territory under this bill.
Representative Franson? No. Okay. Any further discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A6, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? No.
No.
The motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. Our last amendment is the A7. Would the author of the amendment like to move the amendment? And with that one, we might need to do an oral amendment to that one, being that the up to the author. So who wants to claim the A7?
I'm claiming the A7.
All right.
Just trying to find it here.
Representative Franson moves the A7. And with that, we'd like maybe Mr. Burris can explain the renumbering that the oral amendment would be.
Madam Chair and members, the prior adoption of the A8 amendment eliminated the section that's being amended in the A7. So an oral amendment could be to instead modify, amend the A8 amendment. So the change would be to amend the H04138 amendment. And on 1.2, it would be page 4, delete subdivision 4. So in other words, the page and line change would be against the A8 rather than the original bill.
Okay. Representative Franson, would you like to move that oral amendment?
Yes, thank you.
So, all right. All those in favor of the oral amendment to the A7, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. All right. We will move on then to the A7 as amended, and we... So, Representative Franson, if you'd like to explain your amendment.
Yep. So it just deletes that provision and allows the cost recovery by the public utilities. Once again, I don't think that the ratepayers should bear the full burden of this bill, and the PUC has the expertise to decide what the proper cost recovery should be. So that is the amendment, and I'm afraid that if we leave this in place, this could greatly impact the electric utility customers.
Chair Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative Franson, your amendment would take away the PUC's ability to decide and just say that they can't cost recover. So I oppose the amendment. I think that the PUC does a great job of protecting the interest of Minnesota consumers. The news headlines of the last several weeks have shown them turning down rate increases from Xcel, scaling back rate increases from other utilities. They are an excellent watchdog for consumers in Minnesota, and it's one of the reasons why Minnesota electrical bills remain below the national average on the residential scale. I think they do a great job. There's a well-developed body of law in the PUC to make sure that cost recovery is fair, reasonable, and well-supported by economic data. So I don't think that we need to worry about consumers not being well-protected by the PUC. I think they'll do that. I'd ask for a no vote on this amendment.
Representative Franson.
Representative Stevenson, Minnesota has like the 12th highest electricity prices already in place. So I'm afraid that this bill will just make it more costly for Minnesotans. We can agree to disagree. There'll be plenty of discussions as this bill makes its way forward. Thank you. I'd urge a yes vote.
Any further discussion to the A7 as amended? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? No.
No.
The motion does not prevail, and the A7 is not adopted. So we will move on to member discussion for House File 413. Members, any discussion to the bill as amended? Representative Igo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So my question here, Representative Stevenson, is on how we're prioritizing the purchasing of state vehicles. And I see reading in here line 2.18. We were excluding emergency and law enforcement vehicles, and now we have a line in there, are purchased in conformity with the vehicle preference order. Looking back at that order that you have listed, my concern here is especially for my part of the state, I think greater Minnesota as a whole, when we're talking our state troopers, our conservation officers, do we have insurances here that they aren't going to be placed in electric vehicles? Because I'm here to say right now that would be a colossal mistake.
Representative Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative Igo, I think maybe if you look at the section, that clause excluding emergency and law enforcement vehicles remains in statute.
Right, but you added the section.
Representative Igo.
Excuse me. But you added the section here, are purchased in conformity. So you go back to the subdivision you just added there.
Chair Stevenson.
No, Representative Igo. It says ensure that all new and on-road vehicles, comma, excluding emergency and law enforcement vehicles, comma, are purchased. So all vehicles excluding the emergency and law enforcement vehicles have to be purchased in conformance with that section. That's unchanged.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Stevenson. That read really weird to me, so I want to make sure that that was in place. Thank you.
Any further discussion to House File 413? All right, go ahead.
There's no more. I do have one more.
Representative Igo.
One of your testifiers, I believe it was Ms. Backus, mentioned the skyrocketing mineral prices in regards to one of the reasons we're doing this bill today. I guess my concern is kind of twofold, and I just want to see what the response would be. That is something I do not think is going away anytime soon. I think we're going to see increased mineral prices just due to supply and demand. You know, if actually passing a bill like this is going to increase the demand for the limited supply of vehicles that we have, which is already in fact. But then my other concern is, it was also mentioned by Xcel, you know, if we're going to have 1.5 million EVs on the road in Minnesota by the year 2030, if you do simple math on that for kilowatt hours, that's 675,000 megawatt hours that'll be needed to be added to our grid. So my concern is, we don't have the critical minerals for even just the electric vehicle prices to remain stable. How are we going to have them to make sure our grid is reliable enough to support these cars?
Chair Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Igo. A couple of thoughts. One is, I think it's important to note that battery technology is developing all the time. The cost of lithium-ion batteries has dropped something like 80% over the last several years and continues to drop and get better. New battery technologies that aren't as reliant on critical minerals are also being developed and may be soon commercially available, which would be very positive development for that respect. In Minnesota, we have an excellent planning statute. We require our utilities to put in resource plans, as you're aware, that look out many decades in horizon and account for innumerable variables, including massive increases in load due to electrification. And that's one of the reasons why we have a great and stable grid. It's one of the reasons why Minnesota does not experience the kind of catastrophes that Texas did last year when they had the polar vortex, because our grid, our utilities are well regulated, and we require them to be taking into consideration all sorts of different variables in their planning and capacity needs. So I have great faith that our utilities are up to the challenge. Electrification is coming. As I said at the beginning, the demand for these vehicles is very high and is not something that is being caused by the state of Minnesota. It is something that is happening globally and is going to happen regardless of whether we pass House File 413 or not. What we should be doing here is trying to make sure that Minnesotans have access to this technology that they want as soon as possible.
Representative Igo.
I just want to make clear for the record, I'm not opposed to electrification, electric vehicles at all. I just want to make sure that we're using every tool in our toolbox to make sure we do it right. And when we're talking about a bill like this, and we have House File 7 coming on Thursday, that I think isn't going to make sure we have reliable electricity for the electrification of our grid with all these things, I'm going to raise questions and try to have reasonable debate on the issue. I'm not trying to tear apart your bill. I'm just saying, how can we make it better? And I want that on the record because I'm trying to reach across and have these conversations. And I would encourage for you and I to have them in the future.
Thank you, Representative Igo. I think they should form a committee around sustainable infrastructure, huh, to address those issues. Yeah, I'm excited. Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Madam Speaker, and Representative Stevenson. So is there any concern that you have regarding the minerals? In October, the Biden administration did say that batteries from China may be tainted by child labor. That also includes the lithium. And have you also thought about just how many more children are going to be needed, or how many more people are going to be forced into, forced labor, slave labor, in order to meet the demands that Minnesota is going to need? This is a human rights issue. We've spoken numerous times about this issue on the House floor in the previous 2 years. And I really think that we need to acknowledge it, publicly acknowledge it, that this clean energy that you're pushing is made by slave and forced labor. And so what are your thoughts on that?
Chair Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative Franzen. Well, I hope that you have acknowledged and applauded the Biden administration for their aggressive attempts to deal with exactly that problem and develop domestic sources for those minerals and have our supply chains here in Minnesota and in other places for these batteries and other things. I hope that you are encouraged by what the Biden administration did in the Inflation Reduction Act and otherwise, that they have made it a priority to have manufacturing happen in the United States. I think that that's an important thing. And as I said a minute ago when Representative Igo was to his question, the thing that's also important to understand is battery technology is developing and changing all the time. And the next generation of batteries will probably be much less dependent on the type of minerals that you're concerned about.
Representative Franzen.
Thank you. Madam Speaker, Mr. Chair, you are a chair. Representative Stevenson, well, if you are pleased to hear about the Biden administration and we need more domestic mining here in the U.S., why is the Minnesota Democrat Party then so opposed to mining in the Iron Range when we can do it better, safety standards, labor, and know that the minerals that we are mining are coming from ethical sources?
Representative Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative Franzen, I disagree entirely with the premise of the question there, and I think that if Representative Lislegar was here, he might have some words for you about that as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that that's a valid question, and I think that is something that we need to tackle in this session, and I think that's something that Environment and Energy is definitely going to take a look at
I think with the IRA, the limits on the rebates that you can get really are going to make sure that we do ramp up mining and mineral sourcing here in the United States. And I think that, I personally am in favor of getting more jobs into our state and sourcing those minerals. My family is all from the Silver Bay area, so it runs through my veins too. I just think, when we're talking about this, we have to really think strategically and in the long term. And so I think that's really great that we're having these conversations. So Representative Franson, any follow-up?
No.
Okay. Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chair Stevenson, I agree that electric vehicles are coming. They're here. I would feel more comfortable if we did, in fact, let the market decide at what rate they become more accepted, because I think we as government are kind of putting our thumbs on the scale here and incentivizing one particular type of vehicle. And, that we have to have a certain percentage on dealer lots by what, the year 2025, I don't think is really letting the market decide to what level they're going to be accepted. And, I live out on the prairie of western Minnesota, and I think there's a great deal of skepticism, especially in the wintertime when the wind blows and it's 20 below zero, battery efficiency decreases, to a certain percentage. And, I think there's a place for electric vehicles. I'm not so sure it's out, in rural Minnesota in the wintertime when it's 20 below zero. But, we are, I think, putting our thumb on the scale. And then the other thing, I think we're going to hear proposals to a low-carbon fuel standard, which may, in fact, increase the price of our conventional fuels. And these things together, I think, are incentivizing via government the switch or the push to electric vehicles. And I just feel a bit uncomfortable with that, talking about the grid capability and things like that. But I agree that the vehicles are here. They're exciting. They're new. They're different. The ads on TV are kind of, they make it look kind of sexy to have an electric vehicle with all of the eye-popping gadgets and stuff and maps. And, but I think there are things we have to think about and move ahead in terms of electric capabilities and the differences here in Minnesota, being in a northern climate, the decrease in battery efficiency as we move ahead. But I still think there's a place, a big place here for conventional fuels and biofuels. But just thanks for listening.
Chair Stevenson?
No, I think, Representative Anderson, you make some important points. I think electric vehicles work for a lot of people, and I actually think they work for a lot of people who live in rural communities. I think that, but they may not work for everybody, and we're not talking about requiring them, anyone to buy one, other than, I guess, the government, but not any people out there in the world, right? But I actually think that you might be surprised to the extent that they do work, and I know people who live in rural communities who have electric vehicles and are very happy with them. As range extends beyond 300 miles in some vehicles, even if you lose, 20-25% on a very cold day of your range, that's still sufficient for most people's daily needs, even in a rural community where you drive a little bit more than you might in an urban community. So the technology is getting there. I would say it is there. But I understand the concern, and change is difficult. And one of the big things about this bill is to try and smooth that change to make it easier on a lot of players out there, whether it's consumers with the cost or dealers with the new training and technologies that they need to operate. What we're really trying to do here is make this change that is happening, regardless of what we do in this bill, make it easier for Minnesotans.
Representative Anderson, you follow up? Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Stevenson, I appreciate this bill and the conversation today. So back again to page 2. And particularly in our 2.18, 2.19, Would Representative Stevenson, would you say that snowplows in Minnesota, are those emergency vehicles?
Chair Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative Schultz, I don't know that I would call them emergency vehicles, but I would direct your attention also to lines 2.9 and 2.10, 2.11, 2.12, which I probably think maybe more directly gets at the concern that I think you're articulating. So if a vehicle, if there isn't an electric snowplow available or one that meets the needs necessary for the given operation, then we certainly give the commissioner the authority to totally reject the priority above. So I don't know is the answer to the question of whether it would fit into the emergency vehicle, but I think we're covered either way.
Representative Schultz.
Well, I appreciate the fact that you have that additional language to, you know, kind of lay out the priority on this. I think that overall, that is the concern, right? With you know, we certainly live in a place with some pretty cold winters, and what has been mentioned at multiple points during this conversation, whether you're in the far vast parts of northern Minnesota or wherever you might be, there isn't the electric charging stations that are available for any of these purposes. And, you know, I think about in my district, I think there's literally only one. There's only one electric charging station in my district. And so I don't see how this can work and accomplish these goals of, you know, protecting the environment when we don't have that capacity. And that's why I'm so disappointed that you didn't choose to take Representative Anderson's amendment to those standards, because, you know, we do have the flex fuel capabilities in rural Minnesota currently. And I certainly don't want to hear a story, might be within the next 2 years, of some state employee being stranded because they can't get home because they're in a state vehicle that has run out of its charge in the vast parts of northern Minnesota.
Chair Stevenson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Schultz, you know, you mentioned that your district only has one charging station. I can tell you authoritatively that that's not correct, because most people don't charge their stations at a station. They charge it at home. So in the new way that we do this, your charging has happened in your home. So I would argue that there are literally thousands of charging stations in your districts, because each electric vehicle owner, the primary place where they're going to charge is going to be at their house. I've owned an electric vehicle for coming up on 4 years now. I could count on maybe one hand, for sure two, the amount of times that I have charged a location that is not my work or my home. You don't do that. You plug it in overnight, and your range gets you through the rest of the day. You plug it in when you get home at the end of the day. And as I was saying to Representative Anderson, you know, my EV, which is a Nissan, I bought a used Nissan Leaf 3.5 years ago. I did not get one of the sexy cars that Representative Anderson was talking about. Mine is decidedly unsexy. And you can see it in the SOB garage any day, and you will definitely agree. But nonetheless, it meets my needs. But it only has a range on a summer day of, you know, 100, 110 miles, which is, in the compared to the vehicles in the commercials, pathetic, right? I mean, if you have a 300-plus mile range, unless you are going on a road trip, you are probably going to be charging at home. Even if you live in a rural community, you're probably going to be charging at home pretty much exclusively. And that's why the utility provisions in this bill are so important. Because ultimately, what we really aren't talking about with this new model is having, you know, as many charging stations as we have gas stations now, because that's where how you refuel your gas vehicle. But most people, their interaction with charging is going to happen in their garage or in their driveway. And that's where they interact with the utility, not with a gas station.
Representative Schultz?
Yeah, Representative Stevenson, to your point, do you know how far the constituents in my district travel to go to work every day if they work for a state agency?
Chair Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative Schultz, I couldn't speak authoritatively. I'm sure there are some who travel very far. And if they travel so far, the bill gives the tools to not have a vehicle if the vehicle doesn't meet those needs. I'm sure there are lots of state agency employees in your district who drive AT&T cars who don't travel more than 200 miles in a day.
Very good. Just please consider that as we move forward to this bill.
Thank you. Any further discussion to House File 413? Seeing none, Representative Stevens, would you like to comment on House File 413 as amended?
I appreciate the, thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the good discussion today. I think this is an important bill. As I mentioned, and as we've said repeatedly, you know, this is a transition that's occurring. Ford, GM, Mercedes, Volvo, Volkswagen, even Jaguar have all announced intention to phase out gasoline-powered vehicles and switch entirely to electric vehicles. The demand is there, and it's there in unexpected places. When Ford rolled out their F-150 Lightning in December of 2021, the wait list was instantaneously 3 years long. Okay, people want these vehicles. They want them here in Minnesota, and we should make it easier for them to have them. I'd ask for a yes vote.
Thank you, members. All right. Seeing no further, I renew my motion that House File, I renew my motion to re-refer House File 413 as amended to the Commerce, Finance, and Policy Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 All those opposed?
Nay.
The motion prevails, and you are anyway. Thank you, Representative Stevenson.
Thank you.
Representative Hansen, would you like to come up and present your bill, please? All right. I will move to re-refer House File 246 to the Transportation, Finance, and Policy Committee. Representative Hansen, please go ahead with your presentation.
Welcome thank you, Chair, and thank you, committee members. My comments today will be short because this is a fairly straightforward bill. House File 246 seeks to do two things. First, it repeals the statutory prohibition on an old rail line that runs through my community. It's called the Dan Patch Commuter Rail Line. If you've been in this body for a while, you've probably heard about it. This is and has been a priority for the city of Savage in my district for over 20 years, since the prohibition was put in place in 2002. They would like to consider the future growth and opportunities that this line offers our community, but this bill does not allocate any funding, nor does it call for any studies. In time, I will come to you with more information about my community's desire to conduct a study on this line, but at this time, I'll spare you all the details about the history and the conversations that have happened in the South Metro around commuter rail line in general. This bill simply repeals the prohibition and empowers my local government and promotes their local control. Our residents should not be left out of the opportunities to do as they wish with this line because of an overreaching state statute. The second purpose of this bill is about a line in Rochester. In my work around this issue in my community and through the mentorship of Chair Hornstein, I learned that there is also a similar prohibition that exists in Rochester. And so this year I've partnered up with our Rochester delegation and included that statute in this repealer as well. Again, there are no studies or funds included in this bill for either line. I just think that local governments are best suited to determine if they want to discuss or study these lines, and these outdated prohibitions do nothing more than hinder growth and local control. And with that, Chair, I will turn it back to you.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. So we have public testimony first from Timothy Marino, and then next up will be Jess Cook. Timothy, if you could make your way to the rostrum, yep, and just state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Timothy Marino. I appreciate the opportunity to come before you today to strongly advocate for House File 246 to be passed, allowing for the Dan Patch Line and the inner city rail line between the Twin Cities and Rochester to be studied, thereby removing the gag rule, which hinders the ability of our infrastructure to be sustainable. According to the EPA, transportation is the highest source of greenhouse gas emissions. Within this sector, light-duty vehicles such as cars make up the majority of these emissions. We must reduce our car dependence in order to make a dent on climate change, and electric cars alone are not going to solve this problem. One thing that is too often missed with thinking about transit is we just think about people commuting into downtown. For me personally, it's been the opposite a lot of times. For example, like in Southern Lakeville, there's a big job center by 215th Street. Includes an Amazon, FedEx, Hearthside Foods, and dozens of other employers. And I've had multiple job offers over there. I just can't get there because the closest bus that doesn't just go downtown in the morning and back out to the suburbs in the evening is 7 miles away from the jobs that could get there. And they would have paid me more than other ones. I just don't have the access to it. What does this say about our state and our commitments to sustainable infrastructure and economic mobility when we build new industrial centers, attract major employers, but then gatekeep access to these positions behind the steering wheel with an average yearly cost of over $10,000 to own and operate? This is just one potential station on the Dan Patch Line. Looking beyond to the rest of the line, we see its potential to connect our downtown and the many transit routes that feed into it, into the stations of the West End, the mixed-use districts of Grandview, the office towers of Normandale Lakes, and the downtowns of Savage and Northfield with its two colleges. As for rail to Rochester, Rochester is already investing in public transit with the Link BRT, and Mayo Clinic is a global destination for healthcare. We need to connect it to the largest metro in the state. The Federal Railroad Administration's 2021 Midwest Regional Rail Plan has also stated that Rochester should be connected as a possible mainline route from the Twin Cities to Milwaukee and Chicago. This route is the only one in the Midwest to be recommended to have a service tier of Core Express, which would call for 24 trains per day, operating in excess of 125 miles an hour between Chicago and the Twin Cities. Rail to Rochester can get us closer to this bold vision. While some may point to the lack of ridership on North Star Commuter Rail, this is a result of an outdated transit planning mindset built around park and rides instead of creating transit-oriented development and reaching already existing dense nodes, as the Dan Patch Line will do. Also, crucially, at its peak, it only ran six times per day per direction. I mean, if your garage only opened like six times per day, I couldn't rely on it. I don't think many of you would either. In conclusion, this is why I am calling on the members of this committee to repeal this gag order and for allow the study of these routes to commence. We must determine if these routes are feasible. And if we are serious in creating sustainable infrastructure, we must be allowed to study it. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Marino. Next up, we have Jess Cook, followed by Mr. Rand Carlson. Okay. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Cook. If you could just state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jesse Cook. First, I'd like to thank the members of the committee for the opportunity to speak on House File 246. The moratorium imposed on the advancement of regional and commuter rail is, to be blunt, short-sighted and a gross misplacement of priorities. While our passenger rail has fallen by the wayside, both our state and our country have sunk billions of dollars into our highways, a necessary but massively overdeveloped form of infrastructure. Our nation's interstates have devolved into nothing short of a financial sinkhole, requiring increasingly more state and federal subsidies to sustain something that destroys itself as quickly as we can throw down concrete and asphalt. Rail, on the other hand, creates wealth where it's built in the form of a long-term economic return. This is so often overlooked by policymakers who concern themselves almost exclusively with the high upfront costs of these projects, like those proposed in our own state. This is a pattern that dates back almost as far as the automobile itself. When considering a transit project, politicians and citizens alike balk at the high price tag, and they assume that this type of spending is inherently wasteful. As a result, many proposals never see the light of day. And yet, highway projects are never held to the same standard. In 2020, a case study was published entitled "Assessing the Property Value and Tax Revenue Impacts of SunRail Stations in Orlando, Florida." Preceding a thorough analysis of the many economic and the many economic benefits attributed to Florida's largest commuter rail, they noted the following. Community support for public transit could come more easily if transit systems demonstrate positive fiscal impacts beyond those achieved through fare box returns. Transit systems have the potential to generate additional public revenues through catalyzing development around transit stations, yielding increased property values and property taxes. This is what is commonly referred to as TOD, or transit-oriented development. It's the type of small-scale, mixed-use urbanism that naturally forms around major transit stations. And this is exemplified in the Chicago metro area, for example, as the outskirts of the city are riddled with small, charming town centers. Incidentally, these are the economic powerhouses of their respective suburbs, and they exist because of the metro stations serving these areas. That's why I encourage everyone in attendance to look beyond the fare box. Whether you're a concerned citizen or a policymaker protecting the financial interests of your constituents, I implore you to recognize that rail is a worthwhile investment and a crucial part of escaping our wasteful and inequitable reliance on car travel. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up, we have Mr. Rand Carlson. I believe he is virtual. So if you'd like to introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony, welcome to the committee.
Hi. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Rand Carlson, and I thank you for the opportunity to speak on behalf of the University of Minnesota Railroad Club today in strong support of HF 246. We care deeply about reducing emissions and improving transportation options for residents. Ending the gag rules prohibiting the study of the Dan Patch Corridor and intercity rail between the Twin Cities and Rochester will get us one step closer to both goals. As many examples have shown us, building transit also leads to strong private investment interest. People want to live near transit lines and are willing to pay a premium to be within walking distance of a high-frequency stop. Metro Transit data from 2021 showed $1.6 billion in construction permits approved near high-frequency transit and another $9.7 billion planned. The Dan Patch Corridor has the potential to add to this, with likely stops in or near mixed-use hubs in St. Louis Park and Edina, and the potential to add several more. In addition to this, Rochester is planning an entire neighborhood named Central Station around the site they plan to host a station for the Zip Rail project. The investment in this neighborhood will likely be in the hundreds of millions, bringing much-needed tax revenue to Rochester and adding many riders to an already large ridership base for the project. Ending the planning moratoriums for the two lines will connect major regional destinations to the wider Twin Cities and allow for a greater variety of trips to be made easily. Major college campuses such as Carleton College, St. Olaf, and the University of Minnesota Rochester will have easy connections to the routes and will be major ridership generators. Both lines should be slam dunk successes, and the value generated by the developments should be far greater than the cost of the lines. And ZipRail has the potential, as mentioned by other speakers, to be connected to a wider Midwest high-speed rail network. I, for one, can see myself riding these two lines regularly to access leisure destinations, to visit friends and family, and to commute in the future. I implore the committee to vote yes for 246, as with it, a much better future for the Twin Cities and greater Minnesota can occur. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Any other testifiers from the public that would wish to speak to House File 246? All right, please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yeah, hi, my name is Katie Nicholson, and I am in support of this bill, HF 246. I think that the Dan Patch Corridor is one that is very important to study. It's one that I personally feel very close to as someone who grew up in the South Metro. I grew up in Burnsville. And we can see in the South Metro right now that an example we can turn to right now is Burnsville with the Orange Line. Their Heart of the City station is starting to be built up. Their mixed-use development is taking hold. It won't be just for them at Heart of the City. They're also looking to redevelop Burnsville Center, possibly in coordination with County Road 42 bus rapid transit as well. And I think that that is a great example that we should look to when we are considering stations for the Dan Patch line, for the inner city line. I think that it is important that we continue sustained growth rather than, continuing to build out sprawled out car infrastructure. There's a reason that places like Burnsville are starting to build more transit-oriented development. Recently, they've struggled heavily with gaining a tax base. They've had to close schools in the Burnsville Egan Savage District due to a lack of tax funds. And so I think that this is a great way to sustain economic growth, not just for, everybody who's within these corridors, but rather the Twin Cities as a whole, Minnesota as a whole, especially as both the Twin Cities and Rochester are heavily growing. So yeah, I am very much in support of studying these rail lines. I think we need to consider this more as just, it would be a very good investment. I think that we need to look past the initial cost. I think that development would make up for it very much so. And as the Twin Cities continues to grow, I know a lot more people personally who aren't from here. that aren't going to move to just Minneapolis or St. Paul. They might look towards the suburbs, for example, like Burnsville, like Savage, maybe places in between, the Twin Cities and Rochester, that sort of thing. So yeah, I'm very much in support.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I believe we have one more testifier online. If you could please, if possible, turn your camera on and state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair. I am Darwin Schaeferlein. I am a Twin Cities resident in Bloomington, and I have family all across the state in northern and southern greater Minnesota. I am here to provide my support to the bill, not only as a Bloomington resident who can see and would live nearby one of the proposed Dan Patch stations and could definitely benefit from it, but also having family in greater Minnesota who do go to universities like Rochester who would seriously benefit from this, as many of my family are without cars. There are quite a lot of people I know, even outside of Minnesota, who are wondering about why we have these moratoriums in the first place, because if you look to the rest of the United States and the lot of greater intercity commuter regional rail plans, Minnesota has been falling behind our neighbors and our other greater progressive states in the country who have been putting down billions of dollars into expansion of their rail systems, whereas we have slam dunk corridors in cities that are rapidly growing in population, and not just the suburbs, but in greater Minnesota. Rochester, Minnesota already has some of the most aggressive plans for infill development and new transit of a city of its size. In fact, Rochester, Minnesota is considering bus rapid transit and building it before Rochester, New York, despite being a quarter of the size. Though this bill only removes the moratoriums and doesn't guarantee any funding, we almost certainly will see more interest and investment in this as soon as they can lift the moratoriums. And honestly, it is an environmental mistake that a line like Rochester Zip Rail was banned, an electrified, likely, higher speed or high speed rail line, when in the very same year, the Line 3 oil pipeline replacement project was approved. And yet, Rochester Zip Rail was banned for environmental considerations. This was a gross negligence and gross overstep of government authority. When you have Rochester's mayor wants high-speed rail, we want high-speed rail in the Twin Cities, you really don't see this kind of support from legislators or the public with many projects in North America for transit. So we definitely need to have these moratoriums lifted for the sake of giving us a chance to explore what we can do as taxpayers and policymakers with the money that we provide and should be able to choose to use that on infrastructure projects that will give us better investment. Thank you, everybody, for giving me the time to speak, and I hope you can pledge your support to this bill.
Thank you so much for your testimony. I don't think there's any other testifiers to this bill, so with that, we will move to member discussion. I just wanted to take a moment and talk about one of the reasons why I thought that this was a good bill to come before our committee. I've done a lot of research into IIJA funding, and I just want to make sure that we are covering our bases when we're applying for these grants. And so part of that is making sure that we're examining all the alternatives to a project. And so when the locals come to us, there's requirements that they look at a certain amount of alternatives for the project. And so I would just like to make sure that all of the alternatives are covered so that when our state is applying for funding, that we have the strongest possible grant application. And that if we're going up against another state who has looked at all these alternatives, we might be at a disadvantage. And so I just want to thank you, Representative Hansen, for bringing this bill forward. Is there any other discussion to the bill, Representative Franzen?
Thank you, Madam Speaker, or Madam Chair.
That's the third time you've done that today. Getting a promotion.
Maybe it's,
you'll vote for me?
In your calling here. Well, let's, if you want to switch to my side, they could use an extra vote over here. This bill here,
In 2017, I have to read this, the comments from the study here. 2017, the study was done by the city of Edina on this particular project, which the public participation findings were over 2,300 people attended 24 different city council, county board, neighborhood, and community organization meetings and public open houses. Of the approximately 600 people who attended the five open houses and commented on the project, approximately 70% opposed and approximately 30% supported the implementation of the commuter rail in the Dan Patch corridor. Recommendations, although implementing passenger rail transit service in the Dan Patch corridor is physically possible, the real and perceived adverse impacts to adjoining land uses and the cost of improving the right-of-way and operating the system made the corridor improvements impractical at the time of study. I know there was that mention of Rochester being in full support, but there's Edina. This is back in 2017 now, but that is what the study had shown. And then I have this letter from the city of Lakeville, and I do apologize that you don't have it because we got the letter a little late yesterday. There was miscommunication of when the committee was going to, or this committee was going to hear this bill, so I apologize. But if anybody wants this letter, I can definitely email it.
And I believe it was emailed to the committee.
Okay, good. Okay, so as you see and then in this letter, the city of Lakeville is also opposed to this particular project. And then it also states continuing cost overruns with existing rail projects. It is unlikely that a commuter route such as this would ever come close to being financially successful. And I say that because the first testifier mentioned, the current system of highway funding is a sinkhole. While no one has to look farther than Southwest Light Rail for that sinkhole, a major boondoggle. If you are interested, you could just do a little Google search of Southwest Light Rail, and you will come up with a very good article that says, and this is dated September 29th, 2022, so just a few months ago, Minnesota Light Rail project is 9 years late, billions over budget. This is by MinnPost. The article previous was Engineering News. MinnPost, Southwest Light Rail's rocky mess. This is July 20th of 2021. We did do an amendment, was it last year, to audit the Southwest Light Rail, right? I think that passed on bipartisan support to do that. So I would be very cautious moving forward and to, you know, I hope this isn't going straight to the floor, that it makes other stops, because I am certain that there will be more than just four. I think there was, four testifiers on this particular bill, and I'm sure you will be hearing a lot more as it goes through the committee process that it doesn't exactly have the support that you may think it has. But thank you.
Thank you, Representative Franson. And it is going to transportation, finance, and policy. And I think that's the thing about lifting this moratorium is that then we'll actually be able to do those studies. And then that way it will, then the locals can decide whether, it's a viable alternative. Representative Franson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If we want to talk about lifting moratoriums, this is off topic, but we could also have a very good discussion on lifting the moratorium on nuclear energy if we're interested in moving conversations elsewhere on clean energy. So I just would like to encourage the body to take that seriously.
Thank you. Any further representative, Representative Kraft, then we'll go to you, Representative Schultz.
Just a question, actually, and this is, I don't know, the nuclear moratorium we have in place, is that a moratorium on studying the issue, or is that a moratorium on actually producing?
I think that gets a little beyond the scope of this committee. it is a good question.
Sustainable.
Yeah. And so I would maybe suggest that we talk about that offline and then with the chair of the Energy Committee as well, if it's something that we do need to.
Could we actually get that on record?
Representative Kraft, did you have any follow-up to that? Okay. Representative Schultz.
Okay, I'm going to take us back to the issue at hand, but most particularly the history on this particular bill, Madam Chair and Representative Hansen, is that it appears that there has always been a bipartisan opposition to these projects, and that was put into law over the last 20 years. And so I don't know why this legislature would be interested in taking this in a different direction. And then more particularly, I just want to really appreciate what I'm hearing from across the aisle, that we're going to place all of this opportunity throughout this legislative session to empower local officials on how climate, green energy, and the like will be adopted in Minnesota, because that's not certainly what I'm seeing across the line in terms of the agenda this session. So if that's what we're doing here, you know, I just encourage the majority party to adopt that strategy more fully through the breadth of the bills this legislative session.
Thank you, Representative Schultz. I can only control what I can control. So we'll do it here for sure. So Representative Hornstein.
Thanks so much, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Hansen, for bringing this bill. I support it. I think the issue is not so much whether you support or oppose these lines. It's the use of state law to prohibit the very study. And this is actually from, I think, almost 10 years ago. Times have changed. I don't know if anyone is coming forward with wanting a study or not, but I think it's just simply not necessarily a debate about the efficacy of commuter rail as much as the state telling people they can't even study an issue. So that's really why I'm voting yes for the bill.
Thank you, Representative Hornstein. Any further discussion? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, members, for engaging in this conversation. As I said in my testimony, this is simply a repealer. The conversation about whether or not it's effective or not, we can't even have those conversations in my community, and we've wanted to for over 20 years. I grew up in the South Metro. I can tell you that trying to get anywhere on 35W or trying to get across any of the rivers is a pain. Some days it takes me 45 minutes to get here. Some days it takes me 20 minutes to get here. We need to expand additional options to folks in my community who have been left out of a variety of bus lines and a variety of other transportation options. So this simply allows us to have that local control, because that means that communities like mine get to speak up for what they want. What you've heard here today is just a glimpse into the kind of support you will see when I bring a study bill forward. And I'm looking forward to my community rallying around this and allowing cities like Edina and Lakeville and Burnsville and Savage to sit down and talk about this in something other than just a public forum, because they can't do any of that right now. I don't think it's fair that the state stops us from being able to study our own infrastructure. I don't think it's fair that we can't have these conversations. And so I look forward to passing this bill here and allowing this prohibition, both of them, to be lifted.
Thank you so much, Representative Hansen. And with that, I renew my motion to re-refer House File 246 to the Transportation Policy Committee, Transportation Finance and Policy Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Members, that concludes our agenda for today. Our next hearing will take place February 1st at 8:30. I hope that we're in the state office building. Representative Franson.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, just regarding that, is there a way we can just stay here? Because I've, you know, members on both sides of the aisle are like, oh, yeah. I guess we're not in room 10. And we would just appreciate.
I think the only consideration is that if other committees that meet at this time need remote testimony. And so that's why I've been kind of hesitant to like claim this room as our own. And so it's a discussion that maybe we can check back with some of the other committees that meet at this time. Just anticipate. I will let you know. I keep bugging Anna. Send out a reminder so we know what room we're going to. And then I forgot to text you this morning about it, too, so sorry about that.
And thank you, Madam Chair. And just in regards to that, would it be okay, would it be appropriate for Anna maybe just to send out a group text to all of us?
Yeah.
And then we would have that information. Would that be okay?
Yep, we can do that.
We can get, my members will get you our cell phone numbers.
Great, thank you. I appreciate that. I think, you know, it's been nice to be able to have some of these folks zoom in and testify, and with wanting to hear voices from across the state. Wanted to make sure we had that option, but also want to make sure that other committees have the option too. So with that, our meeting is adjourned. Thank you, members.